Marsha Gessen is a renowned Russian-American journalist, raised in Moscow. Their family moved to Boston when they were 14. They returned to Moscow 10 years later, working as a journalist, writing several books, including a biography of Putin, The Man Without a Face, and becoming one of the most public faces of the LGBTQI activism there. Anti-gay legislation and personal targeting of them prompted their return to the United States in 2013. So Gessen has been outspoken in criticism of both President Putin and President Trump. They're a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine, and their new book, called Surviving Autocracy, aims to remind people of just how abnormal Trump's presidency has been. The book has been described as an inventory of awfulness, and it draws parallels between Putin and Trump. It's a powerful polemic. Marsha Gessen is with me now from New York. Hello.
Hello.
Let's just talk about Trump's lies for a moment. They were laid bare in the debate which we saw on our screens yesterday with regard to his statements about COVID. We have already been accused this morning of being grotesquely anti-Trump and spreading anti-Trump propaganda. You write, the lying president is an existential threat to journalism. What do you mean?
Well, as journalists in the United States and I guess around the world, we are in a bind. We generally think that we shouldn't amplify false statements, but what do we do, or we shouldn't amplify nonsensical statements, but what do we do when those statements have real life consequences? And I'll give you a very simple example, right? Trump says, I've heard that disinfectant can be effective against COVID. How about we try injecting it, try it directly in the lungs? Now, that statement is nonsensical on the face of it. Furthermore, the next day, Trump says he was kidding. But we can't just ignore it. We can't pretend that he didn't say it, because that night, within hours of him saying this, poison hotlines around the country were overwhelmed with calls from people who were either considering injecting disinfectant or had already injected disinfectant, right? So it's the most simple example of a false or nonsensical statement having grave real-life consequences. This is something that we actually deal with this president all the time. We can't laugh off his statements because they have consequences, and we also can't treat them as normal because they're not, right? And that's a constant bind, constant tension.
The book's original seeds were sown, if you like, in an essay that you wrote just after the 2016 election for the New York Review of Books called Autocracy, Rules for Survival. Now, at that point, many commentators believed that Trump would become presidential, that his weird kind of rhetoric and behavior was an electioneering device, and that he would grow into the role. What made you believe that he would not? Because it was a prescient essay you wrote.
Right. It's interesting that you use the word believe, not thought, right? Not argued. Because indeed, people believed for absolutely no reason, with zero evidence, that he was going to change and he was going to become somebody who he has never been. I can't tell you why people believed that, because you certainly couldn't make a rational argument for it. You couldn't provide any evidence for it. You could only believe it because your experience of life before Trump suggested that someone like Trump could not be president. So you thought, well, if someone like Trump can't be president, but he has been elected president, then surely he will have to change to fit my view of what's possible, rather than I will have to adjust my view of what's possible because he has been elected president, Right? That's the sort of the sum of my argument, not a terribly complicated one. And I wouldn't give myself any credit for being prescient. It's just like being rational.
Putin, you have said, because inevitably comparisons can be made, you have said he has no objective but to plunder and stay in power, helped by a largely acquiescent society conditioned by years of totalitarianism. Now, at that point, the comparison breaks down, because even though Trump's objective has been similar, it seems, the US society is surely quite different from Russian society, which has a history of trauma, in your words. Why was Trump able to thrive?
That's a great question. And obviously, it's been a very interesting question for me to grapple with, because I have spent so much of my career writing about Russian history. And while I, you know, I think of myself as sort of more rigorous and smarter than being merely deterministic, still, that's how we tell stories, right? We look at history and we think that that stories that flow logically and that use history make the best stories, and then you get transported to a place that would seem to be entirely different, right? The political history of the United States is vastly different. The political culture of the United States is vastly different. Our attitude toward memory and sort of self-identity in this country is vastly different from Russia. So why are we seeing the same kind of behavior enabled by American society? Now, maybe we're just going to see American society finally say, you know, this is not going to work, and turn Trump around by voting him out of office in a couple of weeks. I very much hope that this is the case, and this will show, in that case, that, you know, different histories do yield different results. But it still doesn't answer the question of why Trump has been able to get such a foothold with at least 40% of the population, and why he has been able to turn the Republican Party essentially into an autocratic party. I think there are a couple of answers, but the biggest one, and the one I can provide most quickly, goes back to the work of the great social psychologist, psychoanalyst Erich Fromm, who was writing in the late 1930s about why he thought totalitarian leaders could come to power. Right, he was writing in Germany with Hitler in power, and he was arguing that a sense of dislocation, a sense of catastrophic instability that created a fear of the future led people to want to hand over their agency just so that somebody would provide them with the illusion of returning to an imaginary past and the illusion of stability, right? The promise that somebody would just tell them what the future was going to be like and they were going to march into that future with whoever that person was. And I think that in the United States, people do feel a kind of sense of social dislocation and economic instability and profound, profound insecurity. And Trump speaks to those anxieties quite directly.
Well, Trump did not create that fertile ground himself, did he?
No, Trump certainly did not create that fertile ground. I think Trump, you know, there are two ways of thinking about Trump that are common in the United States. Or one is really common, which is to think of him as an anomaly, as something that has never happened and that, like, came to us from outer space, or at least from Russia. And the other is to think of him as just another Republican president. It's much less common, but there have been arguments that have been made that way. But I think the way we have to think about him is both, right? Nothing like Trump has happened in this country before. And yet, the preconditions for somebody like Trump to enter were created without Trump, outside of Trump, long before Trump. Right? They were created in the aftermath of 9/11 as this country became more and more turned inward, more and more paranoid, more and more creating its identity around a sense of being us against the world. The preconditions were created by the marriage of money and power, by the concentration of power in the executive branch, and certainly they were created by the financial crisis of 2008 and a deep psychic trauma of the financial crisis of 2008 that I think was never addressed. It was addressed very effectively economically by the Obama administration, but not psychically, not, you know, nobody spoke to the anxiety. That doesn't mean that Trump was predetermined, but it does mean that he was made possible.
It also means that even if Trump is voted out on November the 3rd, the Trumpish problems will remain.
Absolutely. And I think this is something that we have to be thinking about very, very hard, right? And we have to be thinking about it as a problem that requires truly deep solutions. It requires nothing less but a reinvention of American democracy.
I believe you're writing another book about exactly that subject, a sequel to Surviving Autocracy, in which you're going to be looking at the kind of reinvention of U.S. democracy. You might like to give us a bit of an insight right now.
It's actually a book about imaginative political projects. And it really starts with the idea that the democracy is a dream. It's always something that we're going toward. It's never something that we have built and inhabit. Democracy is not expressed through parliaments. It is not, it doesn't reside in the courts. Democracy is what we make together as we invent new futures. And so I actually went around the world when it was still possible and interviewed a lot of people who were involved in these, in very small projects mostly, but not always outside state structures, right? Sometimes within the structure of the state or at least a city government. But these projects that where people are imagining new common futures together.
I'm always interested in the sound effects that go on in the interviews that we do, and either you have a train running through your living room or you're standing in a hurricane. Either of those things true?
Well, you're close. I'm actually in my partner's apartment, and she lives in Dumbo, which stands for Down Under the Manhattan Bridge Overpass. So we're in a loft under the Manhattan Bridge, and the subway runs over my head.
Right. Thank you for that explanation. People were wondering, I suspect. All right. Trump, you say, and this gets back to the issue of autocracy. Donald Trump set out, you say, to destroy the American political system. Did he, or was he simply grossly incompetent, out of his depth, just wanted to be famous?
You know, I wouldn't actually make a distinction between those two things. Because his incompetence is militant. His incompetence is very much what drives his desire for destruction, but also what makes the destruction possible. Because I think that if he understood more about government, he might be a little humbled. He might not have unleashed the kind of blunt force that has really damaged the institutions of American government. So these two things go together. He's done vast damage. He's done vast damage to institutions as such, you know, by dismantling federal agencies, by turning the State Department into a ghost town, by destroying the Centers for Disease Control, as we have seen very clearly, right? We have seen such unbelievable government dysfunction and such intentional government dysfunction during this pandemic. This is really a confluence of these circumstances that, you know, a destructive president and a global pandemic coming together to show us what happens when government will not function, when government refuses to function. He has also packed the courts, right? He has made more appointments to federal courts than any president in a single term.
Right, because the response to that is, well, that's what you do in America, right? You pack the courts with either Republicans or Democrats. You're saying that he has done it to an extraordinary degree?
Because he has made a point of packing the courts not only with people who are ideologically close to him, but people whose behavior and backgrounds run counter to the culture of American courts. And that can be expressed, you know, he's appointed bloggers to the courts, he's appointed people with no judicial experience to the courts. Or he has appointed somebody who, you know, nominated somebody like Amy Coney Barrett, who is almost certain to be confirmed to the Supreme Court. Now, obviously, we're seeing a president making 5 years' worth of appointments to the Supreme Court in 4 years, because the Republicans blocked President Obama's nomination to the Supreme Court. But we're also seeing this confirmation process that is clearly illegitimate and perceived as illegitimate by all of its participants. The Republicans have really made a mockery of the confirmation process in the last couple of weeks by, I have a column out in the New Yorker calling it the ultimate bullshit job, using the anthropologist David Graeber's concept of bullshit jobs. But, you know, we have seen Republicans just go on about little warm puppies and ask Amy Coney Barrett if she hates little warm puppies, and eliciting the answer that no, she doesn't, or asking her who does the laundry in her house. I mean, it is an utter mockery that that showcases just how illegitimate they think the process is. And so somebody like that, appointed through a mockery of the process, is also a way of attacking government as it was constituted. And it's not going to be a simple sort of touch-up and repair job if, as I hope happens, Biden comes in. It really will need to be a job of reinventing.
You have a nuanced attitude towards the Russian interference in the democratic process in America. You are skeptical of the attention given to it, even though you have no doubt that it existed. Could you elaborate on this?
Thank you for asking me that. So let me point out just two things. One is that Russian interference consisted of nothing more than Russians have been trying to do for decades, since Soviet times, right? Which is inject doubt and destabilize sort of existing systems, just create a lot of information noise, a lot of haze, and amplify destructive voices in American democracy. And it worked for the first time. And I think the informative part here is that it worked for the first time, not what they were doing, right? There's a place where Russian efforts, which are pretty unsophisticated, and the state of American democracy met at a real low point, right? That's informative. It's not like if we get rid of Russian interference, American democracy will be just fine. It's that we sunk low enough for something like that to possibly have had a real impact. So that's my first sort of injection of skepticism. My other one is that, look, we all have limited bandwidth. As humans, as journalists, as newspaper editors, as whatever. And whenever we're thinking about the hidden, whenever we're thinking about something that needs to be revealed in the hopes that this revelation will explain everything, whenever we're doing that, we're not at the same time thinking about what's out in the open, what can be plainly seen and discussed and addressed right now. Donald Trump has done so much that is blatant, that is open, that is destructive, that we don't need to debate, you know, is it true? Can we prove it? We just know because we can see it, because the evidence is right in front of our eyes. That's what truth is, right? And that's the thing that we need to be paying attention to rather than Russian interference. Not because Russian interference doesn't matter at all, because it matters less.
And yet, you're critical of Robert Mueller, the opportunity that Robert Mueller had was not taken. And this disappointed many of Trump's opposition and you. Institutional restraint is what you've described it as. But does that not demonstrate the strength of the US institutions that you have said Trump has tried to destroy?
I think it demonstrates their hollowness. I think that Robert Mueller's restraint is comparable to the restraint that journalists showcase when they engage in false equivalencies, when they report a false statement and stop short of calling it a lie, right, and say something like, oh, Donald Trump stated without evidence, when they report a racist statement and stop short of calling it racist because somehow they have raised the bar for racist statements, right? I think Robert Mueller did something very, very similar for very similar reasons, right? He has this idea that the FBI has to be above the fray, but above the fray somehow translates into not calling a crime, right? He basically documented obstruction of justice on Trump's part, and without using the words obstruction of justice, threw the ball to Congress and said, okay, well, now that I've documented, they can call it obstruction of justice. Nowhere does it say that the special prosecutor doesn't have the ability to name the crime. There are Justice Department guidelines that say that the special prosecutor probably shouldn't indict a sitting president. These are merely guidelines. And in concluding that those guidelines are, you know, guidelines and recent guidelines, right? In concluding that those recent guidelines are more important than naming a crime, Robert Mueller took a stand by pretending not to take a stand. And that's where I think institutional restraint is actually incredibly damaging.
You've described in your writings, in your books and your writings, the corruption in Russia. Where will it end? The murders of journalists and others who have spoken out, the demonization of Putin's enemies. On a scale of autocracy, Putin is way ahead of Trump. Does contemplating Putin not make Trump seem a little more benign, shall we say?
You know, I wouldn't call Trump benign. But what I would say is that this is a very good moment. Right now, as we're in our election season, it is a really good moment to take stock of all the things we have that we wouldn't have in a full-fledged autocracy. We have a vibrant media. I mean, we have the most incredible journalism, and we've done the most incredible journalism in the last 4 years. We have amazing civil society. We have largely still highly functional court system. We have vast capabilities in our local and state governments, right? We have a lot that we wouldn't have and may not have if we allow autocracy to take hold. And we really need to be flexing those muscles right now.
I've had an interesting text. I mean, a lot of interesting texts from people, obviously. But this one says, as a supporter of Trump, you make me feel, and this is you, Marcia, totally demeaned. The people who speak out against Trump seem arrogant. They can't understand why people voted for him. He is for the people. He calls out precious people and foolish people and elitist people. I could go on a lot longer. Why do news organizations hate him so? Now, I read that out because it is representative of a view that elitist and precious people are against Trump because he is for the people who are not like you. Could you give me your take on that, please? Because it is quite a prevailing view.
Look, Donald Trump came into office, and one of the first things he did was change American immigration policies in ways that directly led to the caging of children, to concentration camps for children. And this is an accurate term.
I think that what people mean is, I take your point, Marcia, but I think what people mean is he is for the American people. And I'm in wherever I'm in, Pittsburgh. I don't care about people who are trying to come into America. I care about whether I've got a job.
I care about what it does to our humanity to be in any way complicit, and I mean complicit, you know, by carrying an American passport, which I do, in the fact that 545 children still haven't been reunited with their parents. I care about being complicit in the deaths of 220,000 Americans so far. You know, Americans, people like whoever is sitting in Pittsburgh and texting this, or I don't know, wherever he is, right? And a million more people who may suffer yet unknown consequences of this horrible disease, right? these are government policies instituted by this president, and they are anti-human. They're crimes against humanity. Now, if you think that Americans are somehow not a part of humanity, then I guess we're not part of the same people.
You managed to get some views of the COVID-19 pandemic in your book just in time, good timing. Do you think that COVID-19 will reduce Trump's popularity because of the dreadful death rate, or boost his popularity because he seems to have emerged as some kind of Superman?
You know, I would rather not speculate. I think that's not...
Yeah, fair enough.
What I can say, and I think this is important, right? Again, we don't know what the outcome of the election is going to be. American elections are really bizarre. American elections ultimately, almost always, have the probabilities of a coin toss, right? I think this is something that people outside of the United States rarely really grasp. But if you look at any American election historically, even when it looks like a landslide, we're talking about, 51 to 49%. Right? So that's probably what we're looking at, whatever the outcome. And so the question we should really ask is, why, after being directly responsible for the deaths of at least 120,000 out of the 220,000 who have died, after being directly responsible for just a catastrophic human, social, economic, and political consequences of this pandemic, can Donald Trump get at least 49% of the vote? And I think the answer is in part because, in general, anxiety, fear, isolation, loneliness are an autocrat's friends. Autocrats are not weakened by making people's lives miserable. Autocrats are generally strengthened by scarcity. Democratically elected and accountable government officials, they tend to be weakened by poor performance. But it works differently for autocrats. And of course, add to that, the whole sort of Superman performance and this idea that you can identify with somebody who is triumphant over disease, and you might have the magic formula for a large part of this country.
The weird thing, this seems like a minor thing, and people who are already texting me to claim that we are anti-Trump, I merely direct them to read your book, which gives a fairly good layout on why a reasonable person might be anti-Trump. But the weird thing about Trump is that he seems to lie. Yes, he seems to lie, but he seems to lie about things that are so obviously not true. For example, as you've cited, the false claims about the weather and the crowd numbers at his inauguration. Why would he do that?
So this is actually where it was very helpful for me that I spent so many years writing about Putin. And this experience is funny talking to you, because in the United States, I'm very rarely speaking to journalists to talk show hosts who might be getting texts about being anti-Trump at the same time, because Trump supporters and Trump opponents listen to different talk shows. But it's a familiar experience to me because I used to be accused of being anti-Putin, as though being anti-Putin wasn't the most natural thing in the world, right? And like, as though most reasonable people wouldn't be anti-Putin. So yes, I am proudly anti-Putin and proudly anti-Trump, and I make my arguments in my books. Now, covering Putin for many years before getting to Trump was very helpful in recognizing this particular kind of lying. I call it the power lie, because the purpose of this lie is not to convince you of something that you don't already believe. It is to show the power to say whatever he wants whenever he wants to. And that's like the kid who took your hat and is wearing it in the playground, and you say, "Give me my hat," and he says, "Well, I didn't take your hat." And he's stronger than you, and so he gets to keep wearing your hat. And that's basically Trump's performance. I say this because I can. I get it amplified because I'm the president. And what are you going to do about it?
Very interesting to talk to you, Marcia. I wish you well. I have an interesting election, as I've said already this morning. Marcia Gessen, Surviving Autocracy is the name of their book.